This episode of Registry Matters is brought to you by our patrons. Thank you for your continued loyalty and support.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West and more West. This is episode 318 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. Are you still battling with vicious, venomous insect and critters to bite you?
Well, I don't know what you would mean by battling. What I do say is those bites healed, but yesterday I was sitting on my sofa and a big spider ran up the wall faster than I could catch. And so I have more desire to have an exterminator. I'm considering that very seriously, to exterminate the house.
That probably seems wise. Chance, how are you tonight?
Wonderful, wonderful. Happy to be here.
And you are a licensed attorney in the state of California.
I am, unless you know something I don't. Yes, I am.
Are you? Do you, what is the term where you get like you work underneath somebody? You borrow their license in another state. Do you have that in any other places?
Like a mentoring program or something like that?
No, not mentoring. Where you, because you're not licensed in that state, you work with.
Yeah, you know, I believe California still has one of those, although I can't be for sure, but I've heard of that. Yeah, this is kind of like a learning by as an apprentice type of thing. Yeah.
I think he's talking pro hoc vici admission when you have to go into another state and you're not licensed. Isn't that what you're talking about when you have to be admitted pro hoc?
That's what I'm referring to, yeah.
Oh, is it? I thought you meant, you know, getting your license here or any other way but going to law school.
No.
Okay.
I mean it if you are going to work with an attorney in another state where you're not, but you're going to run the case, but you're not licensed in that state. I was wondering if you have any of those conditions where you can be in another state as an attorney.
Yes, I can. Yep.
Okay. I don't think that's what I was asking. Anyway, hey, so remember to show your support and hit the like and subscribe button, 5-star reviews and all those places. And then if you feel extra fancy and special, you can head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. And for as little as $1 a month, you can support this program. And I think that's all. So, Larry, tell me what we're going to do this evening.
Well, we have a favorable decision from the United States District Court for the, I think, Eastern District of Missouri, if I remember right, to unpack. And Chance is with us this week, which allows us to have a California corner. We're going to be looking at out-of-state convictions and how they're handled in California. Then we have special for Larry's general rules this week. And I think we're going to have time possibly for one article that's down below.
Uh-oh, I bet you we don't. I'm going to talk really slow, and we won't get to it.
Okay.
All right, well, what is your general rule? What is this? I have an article posted up here that says it's from Searchlight, New Mexico. Inside the shoplifting bust of Albuquerque Journal editor Patrick Etheridge. How is this a general rule?
Well, it's a sad story for Mr. Etheridge and for the Albuquerque Journal, our largest newspaper in the state. And he's been the editor, the executive editor, for not even 2 years. But apparently he was not paying for his merchandise at Walmart.
Whoops.
And the job was advertised at well beyond six figures. And I just don't know what would possess a person to be doing that. But he pled guilty to the shoplifting, and he was sentenced rather harshly to 10 days in jail. And he was having some difficulty explaining his 10-day absence, and the Albuquerque Journal found out about it, and they agreed to part company. My general rule would be, if you earn more than six figures and you live in a modest cost state like New Mexico, you're not in California, New York, or Hawaii, or Seattle, but if you're in a moderate cost city, you probably shouldn't be stealing from Walmart. Now, I would even encourage you not to steal from Walmart, period. But if you must be a thief, don't do it when you earn more than six figures a year, because he just ruined his career. He had had a opportunity to run a medium-sized newspaper after working at all these weekly and small town papers, and he's got his dream job and he blows it.
By what you're saying, is by omission, is it then okay to shoplift at, say, Dollar General?
No, I would encourage people to try to pay for their purchases, but if you must shoplift, don't do it when you're on $100,000 or greater per year.
I see. That's probably reasonable. But if you make 99, is that okay then?
No, it's never okay, but I'm saying especially don't do it when you're earning better than six figures.
I see. I'm just trying to clarify because you said if you do over 100, I was just seeing if there was some kind of fine line in there.
No, you should not be shoplifting at all. And the irony, I'm not going to say funny because you'll have a gut uncork and blow your sides wide open, but if there's any irony in this story, as the Journal has been very critical of lax law enforcement and insufficient penalties, in particular in the recent years since the pandemic and the elevation in crime that has happened, particular property and economic crimes in the Albuquerque area. And the Journal's been very harsh, and as executive editor, he may have been behind some of these stinging editorials that they've written about tougher penalties. Now the penalties have been imposed on him, and I wonder if he feels the same now about tough penalties.
All right. Well, let's head over to a question, and I invite either of you to chime in with an answer, please. And it says, here's a serious question for Larry and or Chance. It has been reported that there are migrants here with PFR type kind of assault convictions. And is it true that they aren't on the registry? And if we know they have these convictions and don't have to register, does that bring an equal protection claim for those others, the others of us that are PFRs?
Well, I'm going to invite Chance to chime in, but I'm going to start with my observations. This sounds like a question from a very angry person. And I feel some sadness for the anger, because these people that he's referring to as migrants, there are groups of migrants that might be here, and some of them might have entered the country without going through any process at all. They may have just skated over the border through being smuggled, paying money to get here, or they may have come through a legitimate process. So he's not clear in terms of what he's talking about migrants. But the inference is he's talking about people with darker skin and that are from south of the border. Well, there very well could be migrants here that have murder convictions and all sorts of convictions. They could be here. We don't have any way of knowing that. We could speculate, and we could spread vicious rumors that the country's filled with all these murders and sex offenders and all this stuff. We could do that, and plenty of people do. But if they have been detected and they have verified that they have a PFR type conviction, and if that conviction was obtained in a nation that provides due process similar to what the U.S. does, they would have a duty to register, and they would be apprised of that duty once they're detected. But until they're detected, it's very difficult to tell someone to register when we don't know that they're here. That's kind of the reason we had the Adam Walsh Act in the first place, because PFRs from within the United States were moving from one state to the other prior to AWA, and the state that they left was happy that they were gone, and the state that they were in did not know that they were there. And they were roaming the countryside undetected and unregistered. But in terms of the Equal Protection Clause, that's really not a very sensible question, because equal protection applies the other way around. You don't file a claim to force someone else to be registered. If there were an equal protection claim, you would be filing a claim saying that you shouldn't have to register because your Georgia conviction is not the same or equivalent to a New Mexico offense, and therefore you're being denied equal protection of New Mexico law. I've never heard of anybody bringing an equal protection clause claim on behalf of this type of scenario. And Chance, you may see it differently, but I just can't imagine what type of equal protection clause claim that there would be.
Well, you know, I just can't even get out there because, you know, it says it has been reported. Like, by whom? you know, but let's just say it was. Then it says, if we know that they have these convictions, and again, you said it well, Larry. I mean, if we know, they're probably going to register. If they have a registrable offense, they're going to register. Okay, so I'm not sure that this question makes any sense, because it assumes, one, that it was reported by whom I don't know, and two, that they have convictions that should be registrable, but they're not. And, you know, just not enough information here to even form a conclusion, really. It's just kind of, you know, information here for me to comment on.
So, well, we will get them registered when it's determined that they have convictions and that they were afforded due process, because there are nations that don't have robust adversarial systems where due process is a joke. And those nations, you might not want to register those people because they may have been a political enemy, and they may have had trumped up charges, and they may have not gotten anything that resembled due process. And that's the reason why that clause is in our law about due process. So anyway, we don't have enough information, but you know, this comes straight from the Dan Bongino show. I can tell you where it comes from.
Very well. Let's head over to what you have entitled the main event, where we have a decision from the United States District Court of the Eastern District of Missouri. I think I have that right. Related to PFRs. And what is this case about?
It's about Halloween signs.
Didn't we already win that case?
Well, we did it in another state in Georgia, but Yes, this is a different situation.
All right. Well, I have read the case several times since it came out yesterday, and you better damn well be prepared for my questions. Are you up for it?
Well, why don't you just let me ask you the questions then, if you've read it many times?
I don't like that idea. I will ask the questions and you will answer them. That's how this is set up. So I'm going to set up the case. On October 3rd, 2023, plaintiff Thomas L. Sanderson brought this action for declaratory and permanent injunctive relief, against defendants Andrew Bailey, the Attorney General of the State of Missouri, and James Hudenick. Boy, we have no idea what that name is, if that's the right way to pronounce it. So that's what we're going with, is Hudenick, or Hudanick, I think I told you earlier. And that is the Chief of Police of the City of Hazelwood, Missouri. Sanderson alleged that Missouri revised statute section 589.426.1, paragraph 3, I think, which requires that any person registered as required under Missouri law must post a sign at his or her residence on October 31st of each year stating, "No candy or treats at this residence," constitutes compelled speech in violation of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. That was a lot. How was that?
You did fantastic. I don't think I need to even be here.
All right. Well, you can check out and I will finish up the program with Chance, and we will have a great time without you and your crankiness. Now, I have heard you pontificate in the past for years using the term legal standing. Some cases have gone down the crapper due to a lack of standing. Now, how does one establish standing?
Well, I will let the court explain that. According to the court, to establish that he has standing to bring this lawsuit, plaintiff, and that would be Sanderson, must show that he suffered an injury in fact. And they referred to Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife, and I'm not going to give the citation. Injury in fact means an actual or imminent invasion of a concrete and particularized legally protected interest. And then again, they cited Kinder versus Geitner, and I'm not going to give the citation. When a state or local law imposes compliance burdens on those it regulates or controls, and compliance is coerced by the threat of enforcement, the controversy is both immediate and real. Now, that's what the court said is required for standing.
And I'm guessing that Sanderson had no problem with the legal standing?
He did not. The court stated plaintiff, a convicted PFR, has proven that he already sustained an injury because he was arrested and prosecuted for violating the Halloween statute. So thus, plaintiff has properly alleged an injury in fact and a threat of future prosecution because they didn't say we're not going to prosecute him again. So he's got what he needs.
And if you don't mind, let's dig a little deeper. What would be a situation where a person does not have standing?
Well, there would be such the court answered that as well. They stated a plaintiff who alleges a threat of prosecution that is not imaginary or wholly speculative has standing to challenge the statute. In this case, the plaintiff clearly satisfied the requirement that the signpost portion of the Halloween statute will be enforced against him, absent declaratory injunction. But the absence of standing would be like, you remember the case from, I think it was Louisville, Texas, case that was taken up to the Fifth Circuit and ultimately a Supreme Court cert petition was filed and denied. But the parents of a PFR wanted to be the parties, and it was questionable whether or not they had standing because they weren't the injured or aggrieved party. But it turned out that the trial judge, I believe, granted them the standing to move forward, and that case went forward. But if you don't get to litigate on behalf of others except for in rare situations. First Amendment is one of those rare exceptions where you can litigate on behalf of someone else. But in this case, he didn't need to be litigating on behalf of someone else because he had the requisite standing clearly from his own situation.
I just want to ask this question. Is this a difference between this particular plaintiff and then the folks in Georgia, where none of them beyond the sign, there was the intimidation. They like felt threatened, but this guy got arrested. Isn't that like a hard line difference between the people in Georgia that hadn't been arrested? They were kind of like, we're going to get arrested. And this guy got arrested.
There's that distinct difference, but the threat is there. That's sufficient. And the court stated that if it's a credible threat, it can't be imaginary. It's got to be credible. And that's what I keep telling you folks about the Adam Walsh Act, about the imagined threat. The sheriff in Butts County, Georgia, said, I will lock you up if you don't do this.
Yeah, comes to your house with the guns and the tasers and 10 guys behind him like, I'm going to lock you up and if you take this sign down. That's a pretty credible threat.
In the case of that stuff with the imaginary boogeyman with Adam Walsh Act, no one has even suggested that a person who's been relieved of a duty to register is ever going to be prosecuted. So that is the case of an imaginary boogeyman.
I gotcha. Can we go back? And what was what did Sanderson do to get him as a PFR?
Well, according to the court, Sanderson and his family moved to Hazelwood in 2000. Shortly thereafter, law enforcement officers interviewed him regarding some allegations of inappropriate sexual touching made by a friend of the family, who was 16 years old at the time. Sanderson was subsequently charged with a PFR offense, and in 2006, he was convicted of that offense by virtue of a guilty plea, which required his registration with a chief law enforcement official in the county of residence under Missouri law. Sanderson testified that he's been convicted of other offenses, none of which involved sexual abuse, including but not limited to domestic assault, driving while intoxicated, and indecent exposure. Kind of a nice guy, wouldn't you agree?
100%. So the court noted that every year since living in Hazelwood, Sanderson had participated in Halloween traditions on October 31st, such as throwing large parties, hosting a bonfire, handing out candy to the chitterns outside, decorating his residence, and keeping his lights on. Plaintiff testified that he did not believe at that time the Halloween statute applied to him since he was convicted prior to its enactment. That was a logical assumption on his part, don't you think?
I do. I think it was very logical, but it turned out not to be the case. But if you look at that law, it was enacted in 08, and his PFR offense happened for 08, so he was being logical, yes.
Right. Okay, well, then what changed that caused the prosecution? What changed there?
Well, not sure other than a new police chief. Chief Hudanik testified that he is the chief of police for the city of Hazelwood, and he has held the position since December 2021. Hudanik testified that his predecessor did not strongly enforce the Halloween statute. However, Hudanik directed his officers to enforce the statute, mainly focusing on interaction with children, such as handing out candy. Hudanik testified that he gave no specific instructions regarding enforcement of the signposting requirement at that time, but after prosecution of Sanderson in 2023, who directed his officers to enforce all sections of the Halloween statute. He also testified he sent a letter to, in October 2023, to all registered PFRs in his jurisdiction, and that he intended to enforce the Halloween statute in its entirety.
That almost sounds like Gary Long in Butts County. Almost.
It does.
This is my county. I'm the sheriff. I'm going to do what I want. I have, oh, not that. There.
I got my rights to do anything I want to do. I'm a police officer.
Do you remember that?
That's pretty funny.
Do you remember that? Okay. The court stated that on October 31st, 2022, Hazelwood police officers testified that they received complaints, including an anonymous tip about Halloween activity at Sanderson's residence. Officers testified that they were dispatched to the residence and observed that it appeared he was hosting a Halloween party. Officers observed Sanderson dressed up in a costume and handing out candy to the children. And his residence was decorated. Oh, the horror, Larry. I'm just like aghast. Decorated with Halloween decorations and lights. Not just decorations, Larry, but decorations and lights. Officers also observed that he did not have a sign posted at his residence that stated, "No candy or treats at this residence." Officers spoke with plaintiff's girlfriend and instructed plaintiffs to cease Halloween activity as he was in violation of the Halloween statute. After receiving further complaints about Sanderson's residence, officers testified that they were again dispatched to the residence and observed that he was continuing to participate in Halloween activities. Officers then informed Sanderson that he was in violation of all restrictions in the Halloween statute. On November 3rd, 2022, he was arrested for these violations. Oh, the horror. He had decorations and lights, Larry. It was really the lights that probably put it over the edge.
Yes, indeed.
Well, so then what was the actual law that is being challenged?
Well, it became effective on August 28, 2008. Missouri enacted Section 589.426, the Halloween statute, which imposes the following restrictions on conduct for any person required to register under the appropriate Missouri law. Avoid all Halloween contact with children, number one. Number two, remain inside his or her residence between the hours of 5 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. unless required to be elsewhere for just cause, but not limited to employment or medical emergencies. Number three, post a sign at his or her residence stating no candy or treats at this residence. And number four, leave all outside residential lighting off during the evening hours after 5 p.m. The penalty imposed for the Halloween statute is a Class A misdemeanor. You got to give them credit for one thing. They didn't charge him, apparently, with all the things they could have charged him with. He had lights on. He had decorations on. And he was not inside the house. They only charged him with failing to put the sign up. Can you at least give them credit for that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So these are the lenient cops. I've always been curious, Larry, about that I guess this says inside. I don't think the Georgia one says inside. Does this mean if you wanted to, like, cook a steak in the backyard on the barbecue, you're not inside? I get that. But are they going to come, like, beat it on the door with the SWAT team if you're cooking a steak on the grill in the backyard?
Not unless there was a complaint and they really wanted to get you. But theoretically, under the strict, I mean, if you're a Scalia, the law says what it says. It doesn't give any variation for that. So, yeah, absolutely. You would need to be inside. It doesn't say inside except for, it says what it says.
Before we go further, can you explain the difference between a TRO and a preliminary injunction? And a TRO was granted at the beginning of the case?
Yes. It's a great question. That stands for temporary restraining order. And a TRO is granted usually ex parte on the pleadings when time is of the essence. The legal standard for getting a TRO is the same, but it's granted without hearing from the other side. And then you're quickly going to have a hearing convened to consider a preliminary injunction, and that will involve both parties. But imagine you draw up your complaint and you've got 24 hours before something bad's going to happen. So you convince the judge to read the complaint and you say, "Judge, I need a TRO here because we're screwed if we don't get this." The judge reads the substantive complaint, taking everything at face value, and does his or her own research, and they determine whether you're likely to prevail on the merits, which is the standard, and will irreparable harm flow if you don't grant it. And then they'll give you an emergency order that's usually very brief in nature, a matter of days, and then they're going to have a hearing where it's truly adversarial. But that's what a TRO stands for, and that's how they come about.
And I think you throw these in here just to show us that you have a big vocabulary. What does ex parte mean?
It means only one party. So like the Sanderson, when he filed this, well, he didn't file it, but when his attorney filed it, that was the only party that was likely heard from on the TRO. Because when you do something ex parte, Chance can do a better job of explaining the limitations. There's very strict rules in terms of ex parte communications, and the pro se litigants don't understand that. They think they can just call up the judge and talk to the judge. Chance, do you want to do a little segment on ex parte communication and the limitations on how strict they are in terms of people want to run talk to the judge and you can't do that?
Well, the criminal world where I practice is just very black and white. You know, you know, most issues, unless you let both sides know and there's a compelling reason and it fits within a legal exception, are not ex parte. It's very, very limited. But there are instances where you'd want to do that. But you got to do a few things. You got to jump in, you know, through a few hoops, and you've got to comply with the law, like, you know, to the letter. So in the civil world, you know, I imagine that you've got to do somewhat the same. It's just something that you just don't, you know, something you don't do willy-nilly, but you know, there are great restrictions. You know, when one side's only speaking to a judge, you know, most of us assume that's not very fair. The other side should know what they're saying. So that's why it's a very limited type of thing.
I'll give you one example, and this is a little bit off script, but an example would be in the criminal world. We've got a client, for example, hypothetical client, and the client comes across to us like they might have mental health issues. They're in custody, and I need to have that client evaluated. I'm not going to tell the prosecution I think my client's nuts. That's not going to serve my purposes. I'm going to tell the judge I need an ex parte order for transport to get that client to an evaluator. And that would be an example where I might, if I had the law license, I would prepare a motion, an ex parte motion, an ex parte order for transport. But in most instances, you're not going to be communicating without the other side knowing everything that's being communicated.
Did the case go to trial, or was it resolved as by your favorite process of summary judgment?
Fortunately, it went to trial. Not sure even if summary judgment was sought by either party, because I did not go through the entire docket. But on June 20th of 2024, the case proceeded to a bench trial. Sanderson appeared in person and by counsel. Defendant Bailey appeared by counsel. Defendant Hudanik appeared in person and by counsel. After trial, the parties requested and the court agreed to give 30 days to file post-trial briefs, which I hate, but they were timely filed by all parties. The only issue before the court is or was whether the signposted requirement constitutes compelled speech in violation of the First Amendment. Having considered the arguments and evidence presented at trial, the court found that the signposted requirement is unconstitutional and therefore unenforceable.
And since there was a trial, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about that for a second.
Yes.
The defense called expert witness Paul Simpson. And that's what is EDD? What is that?
You'll have to defer to the lawyer. I have no idea.
I have no idea what that is. Do you know, Chance, by chance?
Erectile dysfunction? I don't know. I can't make that out.
That's a degree okay. Or a credential he had of some sort.
Okay.
It's like an educational degree.
Okay. My apologies, Mr. Simpson. I have no idea what an EDD is. But anyway, so that individual, he agreed that the signposting requirement could help prevent PFRs from having any type of contact with children on Halloween. On cross-examination, Dr. Simpson agreed that even without the signposting requirement, a PFR compliance with other restrictions of the Halloween statute would prevent the offender from having contact with children at their residence on Halloween. Dr. Simpson also testified that, based on his research, PFRs reoffend at a rate of approximately one-third. One-third? 33% is what he said they reoffend at? Good grief. Where did he get his BS? Like, from the BS school?
I have no idea, because it's certainly not a credible statement.
Holy moly. Did the trial have any other surprises? I mean, that's a big surprise. I mean, I guess it's not really a surprise.
Not really. I expected this outcome. In fact, I wanted NARSOL to do the case, but another organization got it underway while we were still debating internally. So it went forward without us being involved.
Someone in chat says it's a doctor of education. And then the court stated, to decide that the facial challenge here, the court must explore the law's full range of applications, the constitutionally impermissible and permissible both, and compare the two sets. Two courts in other circuits have addressed similar Halloween signposting issues for PFRs, and both have ruled that the signs unconstitutionally compel speech in violation of the First Amendment. A district court in California issued a temporary restraining order enjoining an ordinance that, like the sign posting requirement here, required PFRs to post a sign on the front doors declaring no candy or treats at this residence. That's Doe versus City of Semi Valley. The district court found that plaintiffs clearly showed they were likely to succeed on the merits of their claim that the sign requirement, a form of compelled speech, runs afoul of the free speech guaranteed in the First Amendment. Then there was the NARSOL case that was in Butts County that we were just kind of briefly tooling around. Tell us about that case, though, Larry.
Well, that was McClendon versus Long, and the 11th Circuit held that the local sheriff's department signs that law enforcement placed in the front of registered PFR's homes that said, stop, warning, no trick-or-treat at this address, a community safety message from Butts County Sheriff Gary Long, were a classic example of compelled speech. And that was decided by the 11th Circuit in 2022. The McClendon Court relied on the Supreme Court's holding in Woolley, where the court invalidated the conviction of a New Hampshire couple who covered their state motto, live free or die, on their license plate, concluding that the right of freedom of thought protected by the First Amendment against the state action includes both the right to speak freely and the right to refrain from speaking at all. Since Woolley, the Supreme Court has reaffirmed the prohibition on compelled speech and refined it to apply to cases in which the government orders certain types of speech or speech about certain topics.
I think we should probably wrap this up. But before that, I'm reading on pages 14 and 15, and it says, the court finds the Halloween statute's signposting requirement, like the state motto on the New Hampshire license plate in Woolley, is compelled speech. Plaintiff has proven that the signposting requirement compels him to speak a viewpoint in written words directed to the public that he does not adhere to in violation of the First Amendment. Applying the law's full range of applications, the court further finds that the signposting requirement compels the speech of any PFR in Missouri, not just the plaintiff. See Net Choice with some citation stuff. Defendants require the use of private property to reflect their own message for the express purpose that it be observed and read by the public, thereby depriving registered offenders of their freedom to speak in their own words or not to speak at all. It continues where the judge stated, thus the court finds that the signposting requirement of the Halloween statute mandating that PFRs post a sign that says no candy or treats at this residence on Halloween is compelled speech and is unconstitutional as applied to all PFRs in Missouri.
And the court concluded, for these reasons, the court concludes the plaintiff has met the burden of establishing that declaratory and permanent statewide injunctive relief is warranted. Further, because the court has found the Missouri Revised Statute Section 589.426.1, subsection 3, is unconstitutional. It is therefore unenforceable against not only the plaintiff, but all others subject to this section of the Halloween statute. Now, it's interesting.
Go ahead.
It's interesting that you ask all these gobbledygook questions about how who appointed certain judges. You haven't asked. Now, this was a recommendation by former United States Senator Claire McCaskill to former president, Barack Obama, who appointed this liberal, crazy, left maniac to sit on the bench. So I'll go ahead and tell you, so, since you haven't asked so far, that this is an Obama appointee.
Oh, and this sheriff hasn't made statements on social media saying that I will take this all the way to the Supreme Court, has he?
I haven't heard about that, no, but I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't want to.
So otherwise, then what's next?
Well, there would be a possible appeal to the Eighth Circuit. They would waste their time asking for reconsideration. This is such a well-written opinion. The judge is not going to change his mind, but an Eighth Circuit appeal would be a possibility.
And do you think it would work if they did appeal?
I don't think so. I think with Woolley and the Supreme Court's strong adherence, and with two cases out there, one being from a circuit court in the 11th, and then the California case, I just don't see it. But I mean, here's the thing: when you've got unlimited resources financially, and you can't cut their budgets because you're accused of turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the American citizens, when they have unlimited funds, that permits them to take things on appeal that they shouldn't. So they could.
I'm with you. And apparently, then the way that the counties are funded, I'm pretty sure the way that you told me is, they have an unlimited budget that they would just receive any shortfall from the state.
Well, I'm not sure about Missouri, but in Georgia, if the sheriff wanted to keep going in Georgia, he could have, because they're obligated to fund him on his endeavors because he's the chief law enforcement officer. But what they would have done in the case of Gary Long is they would have said, well, yeah, we'll fund you, but if taxes have to go up because of this enormous legal bill, we're going to make sure the public knows that they can thank you.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, let's move along to this next segment. And this is from a case from Kentucky. And you claim that you believe that everyone is innocent until proven guilty? Now, let's see if you meant it. It says, a Kentucky sheriff shot and killed a local judge last month after seeing his teenage daughter's number on the judge's phone, according to court testimony Tuesday. Police said Letcher County Sheriff Mickey Steins dialed his daughter's number from District Judge Kevin Mullins' phone, then pulled his gun and shot Mullins repeatedly inside his own chambers in the city of Whitesburg on September 19th. Steins and Mullins were longtime co-workers and friends. Police did not explain during the preliminary hearing the significance of the daughter's number in the judge's phone. Wow, this is odd.
So your question is, has my position changed? No, this sheriff is like everyone else. He's presumed innocent until he elects to plead guilty or until he's proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. He deserves a
little... How can you say presumed innocent?
Because that's our system. He's presumed innocent, and the case needs to go forward. He's presumed innocent.
I will say that I think that the police seldom seem to believe in that concept. The evidence is overwhelming. Graphic video played at the hearing appears to show Steins, a hulking man who stands 6'4 and weighs more than 300 pounds, firing on Mullins as he sits at his desk with his left hand up. After Mullins collapses to the floor, Steins is seen leaning over the desk to fire some more. As Steins prepares to leave, the video shows him closing in from another angle, firing his final shots from about 2 feet away. Inside the courtroom, members of the audience wailed and wept as they watched the brief clip. There was no audio. Steins resigned as sheriff and has pleaded not guilty to murder. How can he plead not guilty?
Well, good question. Because he's not been provided any of the discovery. Usually at that first stage, that first appearance, you have virtually nothing in the way of discovery. You're entitled to all the discovery, all the evidence that would potentially come out against you. He's not had time for a qualified attorney to review that evidence. nor has the qualified attorney been able to review the elements of the crime to find out if that is the proper charge. It could be a death that wouldn't merit a first degree charge. He hasn't had time to explore developing the defenses. And he could, beyond that, he couldn't plead guilty even if he wanted to at this stage of the process. No competent judge would accept a guilty plea. When I say that, I'm saying no competent judge would accept a guilty plea.
Chance, do you have any comments on this?
Well, let's just take one element of what Larry just said. Advisement of possible defenses. And here we have Steins firing on Mullins as he sits at his desk with his left hand up, presumably to say stop. After Mullins collapses to the floor, Steins is seen leaning over the desk to fire again. Then as Steins prepares to leave, the video shows him closing in for another from another angle, firing final shots about 2 feet away. Now, I ask you, does that seem normal to you? I mean, if the defendant can demonstrate that they were legally insane at the time of the murder, they may be found not guilty by reason of insanity. In cases of second-degree murder, if the defendant can show that they were provoked into committing the murder, they may be able to reduce the charge to voluntary manslaughter. Either way, no competent defense attorney would allow their client to plead guilty before at least exploring these possible defenses under this scenario.
I would be inclined to think that when you find your daughter's phone number on someone's phone like that, that you could have a fit of rage and have a rash reaction. I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to do, but wouldn't you then also say that a police officer should be kind of like schooled in controlling their emotions to not have those rash kind of reactions?
You'd be asking to put him under a different standard, and we're all judged by the same. So, you know, what's good for one is good for the other.
Anything else, Larry?
No, but I hope that, justice is done, and he deserves robust representation. He deserves presumption of innocence that follows him through the duration of his proceeding. I only invite my law enforcement friends out there, why don't you say what I just said when it's somebody who's not a law enforcement officer? Because I have no problem saying it. I wish you would join me.
Well, very well. Let's move over to the infamous California corner. Registration requirements for out-of-state convictions in the state of California.
Today, we're going to be discussing with Chance the uncertainties surrounding registration requirements for individuals with out-of-state convictions who choose to reside in California. Let's start with the basics. Why is it so difficult to predict whether someone with an out-of-state conviction will need to register in California? Seems like it shouldn't be that complicated, Chance.
Well, you know, you would think so, but the primary challenge lies in the way that California law defines the obligation to register. California references its own offenses, not out-of-state ones, to determine registration requirements. This means we need to establish whether the out-of-state offense is equivalent to a California offense that mandates registration. In many cases, this equivalence is not a clear-cut one and is left to the discretion of the California Department of Justice, the CADOJ.
That sounds a little bit ambiguous. Can you explain how the California Department of Justice determines this equivalence?
Well, certainly. The California Department of Justice, otherwise known as the CADOJ, can take one of two approaches. First, they can compare the elements of the out-of-state offense with those of a California registrable offense. And alternatively, they can examine the record of the out-of-state offense to see if the facts admitted or found true correspond to a California registrable offense. However, this process is complicated and is often unpredictable.
So what should someone with an out-of-state conviction do if they plan to move to California other than calling me? What else should they do?
Well, this is where the rubber meets the road, because if they're not calling you, they're calling me. And that is why we're here doing this. The safest approach is to attempt to register with the California Law Enforcement Agency, a California Law Enforcement Agency, upon moving. This way, the California Department of Justice can make a determination. They can do the homework. If the California DOJ decides that registration is required, the individual can then seek permission to discontinue registering. It's a much safer to comply initially rather than risk prosecution on top of your challenge for failing to register.
So, well, when you say they could seek permission to discontinue registry, would that be like through an administrative appeal process internally?
Or yes.
How would so? Okay.
It would be a direct appeal to the California DOJ.
Okay. So, what role can a California attorney play in this process? Why can't a person just tell them to take another look at it? You guys are always trying to line your pockets. Why can't a person do it themselves?
The thing is you've really got to know this registry backwards and forwards and upside down. And a person from out of state is probably not going to know much about the California registry. So a California attorney can advocate on behalf of this individual before the California DOJ, arguing that registration should not be required. However, it's preferable to make those arguments when the individual is already in compliance with the law rather than defending against a criminal charge for noncompliance. Additionally, any adverse decision by the California DOJ can be appealed to a California court. So you've got a second bite at the apple.
Are there any specific factors that the California Department of Justice considers when making the determination other than what you mentioned above?
Well, yeah, the California DOJ may look at whether the elements of the out-of-state offense match those of a California offense that requires registration. They may also consider the nature of the conviction, such as whether it was a felony or a misdemeanor. Unfortunately, there's no clear guidance from the California courts on how these determinations should be made, adding to the uncertainty because it's completely reliant on policy determinations at the California Department of Justice.
Is there any scenario where an out-of-state conviction might not require registration in California? Is your list and your registry so broad that if you come to California, you're going to have to register? Or are there times when you can extract a person from registering, even though they were required to register in their other state?
There's an exception. Let me give you just one example. There's an exception if the out-of-state offense is similar to California's offense of unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor under 18. In such cases, registration may not be required. However, this is a determination. This determination is also subject to the California DOJ's discretion and can be, as I've said before, unpredictable.
Oh, wow. It's clear that navigating the registration requirements for out-of-state convictions in California is fraught with uncertainties for sure.
Well, that is for sure. And that's why it's important for individuals in this situation to seek legal advice and proceed with caution to ensure compliance with California law.
Someone in chat asked, would someone with an out-of-state conviction be granted credit for time registered in another state, or would the clock start anew?
They would be credited with time.
Really?
Yep. It doesn't matter where you do your time, you get credit for it.
And how long do you have to be on the registry in California?
Well, it's a three-tier system, but it's not really a three-tier system. They say it is because it's tiered 1, 2, 3, but the third tier is lifetime, second tier is 20 years, and the first tier is 10.
Interesting. Very cool. Anything else there before we talk about this article that Larry didn't tell me which article?
No, we've already done the article. We did that first. So we're finished.
Sweet.
Wow.
Holy moly.
Wow.
Very cool. Well, anything else you guys want to kick it about for a few minutes?
Well, I'm happy to be finished. Do we have any new patrons? I know that you said somebody quadrupled last week. Do we have any new ones this week?
We don't have any new ones, but we do have one that decided to change from their exorbitantly high monthly and went for an annual. And so that was very surprising and very much appreciated. But we do not have any new patrons.
Well, have I run any?
How does that work, Andy? How does that work? I mean, what? How do they do that?
Well, at patreon.com/registrymatters, literally for as little as $1 a month. You know, obviously for $1 a month, you're supporting the program by sending us $1, and we divvy it up, and Larry and I go find the highest quality cup of McDonald's coffee that we can find for 50 cents a piece. And you're just showing some appreciation, but some people very, 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 very generously contribute some money, and you're supporting creators back in the day of listening to advertisements on the radio, which does anybody listen to terrestrial radio anymore? Larry does. Chance, do you listen to terrestrial radio?
No, I don't even know what that is.
where you have the antenna sticking out of the car and you pick up WKRP in Cincinnati?
Yeah, I do. I do. Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. I don't turn on the radio at all. I have no idea. Like, my radio actually died. All I do is listen to podcasts in the car. So, anywho, so how does anybody being an independent creator, like, what radio station would support this program? So these are people that are showing appreciation for the program that we put together every week. That's what Patreon is.
This is wonderful. This is wonderful.
Yeah, we've toyed around with selling advertising on here in terms of generating revenue and also more excitement. The problem is trying to find the time to go out and solicit the advertisers, which, who would they be? Who would we target? What would the price be? And what would they get for their money? Would they get to be on the show once a month, once every quarter? You know, what would we put a slide of their law practice contact information? But yes, that would be another way of generating income for the program. But right now it's basically individuals who feel generous and they support us at various levels from anywhere from $1 a month up to quite a bit higher. We've got some really nice people that are quite generous with us.
Some of them even send Larry Fudge.
Fantastic.
Head over to registrymatters.co and you can find the show notes. You can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or, as we were just saying, patreon.com/registrymatters. You can find us on all the platforms that I'm aware of. You can find us on YouTube, on Pandora. I'm sure we're on Spotify because I know somebody that listens to us there. iTunes, Google shut down their platform. But if on any podcast app, type in Registry Matters, look for a blue logo that says, wait for it, Registry Matters. That's all I have, gentlemen. Is there anything that you want to say before we close up shop?
What about the next episode? You mentioned something about travel. Will we be here?
I'm totally going to be out of town. I have to take my kid to a car race that is incredibly far away. And, I will be leaving for a long drive on Wednesday afternoon and I will not be back until Sunday evening.
All right. Then we'll see everybody, all of our faithful fans in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Chance, any parting words? You going surfing?
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, we just appreciate you so much.
Thank you guys very much. Have a great night.
Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.